Welcome to our podcast. This is On Mic with Jordan Rich, an opportunity to chat with people who use their voices for all kinds of good reasons and use their voices to make our lives happier and richer. I am thrilled to have a couple of outstanding voice actors in studio with me today, John and Helen Lasanti. And one would guess that you guys are either brother and sister or married. I'm going to go with the second one.
Yeah, we are married.
Well, based on the accents being a little different, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just a little.
I've known this gentleman, John Lasanti, for going on 30 years anyway, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
And we've worked together.
Yeah, a long time.
And then along came this beautiful Belle from across the pond.
Yes.
Thank you.
Actually, I met her because a fellow that I had met when I was single was telling me about someone who was coming over from England, and who was an actress, as she is and was, and wanted to get into the voiceover business because I had told him what I did. So she finally bumped into me and called me at one point, and here we are doing them together.
How old was Mozart when he wrote his first opera? Good answer. He was 12 years old.
Tropicana Pure Premium and honestly fresh squeezed orange juice. Both start out with ripe, juicy orange.
Welcome to Cambridge University and your online induction. This course provides you with key information to help you settle into your new role.
He was a knobby-kneed colt, loser of six straight. When he went off at 12-1 at Suffolk Downs, he won that day and captured the eye of a legendary trainer.
What a nice union and a great marriage. And you've also brought into the world a lovely young lady who started out doing voiceover at a very early age, Helen.
She did. Well, how old was it? I think she was about two. She did some Halloween thing when she was about two or something. And then she did a series of stuff for classical music. It was a... Those music things about Mozart.
If you can't put your kid to work at an early age,
well, that's right.
Then
absolutely.
What's the point of having them?
Yeah, they have to contribute. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What makes George George? Curiosity, adventure, friends. Have fun with Curious George on PBS Kids.
She doesn't know how much money she made.
Yeah, we never told her.
It's funny when they make more than their old man. In my case, I put my kids to work and they ended up scoring hits because just as a rule. I want to ask you, John, first of all, about your entry into this area, because most people don't start out at Emily's age, your daughter, being voiceover artists. What was the first step into this business for you?
Oh, God. Well... there's like two stages, really. The initial thing happened when I was just a kid because I loved to listen to radio. And somewhere along the line, I got a crystal radio, and that's really going back. Listen to ham people on the on the airwaves, ham operators. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I actually set up a little radio station in my basement with a Lafayette broadcast thing so my neighbor could hear me. And I was spinning records.
Oh, man.
And that was before, that was 1950-something or other. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just liked to do it, but I never continued with it. But I got into broadcasting. I was a floor manager, assistant director for a while. Then I became creative services director for a TV station and continued along that line. I went to like five or six TV stations, including a couple in Boston, Pittsburgh, New York City. And I had to hire a lot of voiceover people because I was doing the creative. I was doing the promos for the air, was writing them, producing them in-house. And in Boston, and I was working with Frank Evroosh, which is a great name, Bozo the Clown. And he was the only announcer we had. And but sometimes I needed to do a dramatic spot for the news. And Frank didn't quite have the voice I wanted. Great voice. So one day I was trying to tell him how I wanted it to sound. And I was actually reading it to him. And he got so angry at me, or somebody didn't, say, why the hell don't you do it yourself? After I left the creative part of a TV station, because I didn't like the corporate life, I abandoned it completely. Somebody said, you could do this. So I started to do auditions, and I made a demo tape, and I've been doing it for 40-something years now.
And by the way, you've been the voice of authority, and you've got that power in your voice. You also have that warmth in your voice. Was this something that you had any training prior to stepping in like that?
No. No, it wasn't. Oddly enough, I was brought up for the most part in New England, but I have no New England accent because, well, actually, you know what? Now that you mention it, I went to Emerson College. And the last 2 years of my college education, and part of the requirement there was everyone, if they had any kind of speech impediment or speech anomaly, that they had to overcome it and speak Middle English.
Middle English. Oh, it's just like in England, we had to do RP, received pronunciation. It's a similar thing. So they had to get rid of your regional accent.
Right.
Right.
And that is something, by the way, that is gone from any public school curriculum here in the States. And very few, unless you're majoring in it, I mean, no one's focusing on elocution or any of that kind of stuff.
True.
Right, right. But it's still in England, am I right?
Well, when I was younger, we all went to elocution lessons. We had a teacher came to our house and we had elocution lessons. And then I decided I want to go into theater. But basically, the whole thing about RP, received pronunciation, in England was, I guess, in the 90s, very big. But then, nowadays, then there was a switch away. People wanted more regional. If you listen to the BBC, you'd hear many more regional accents.
Well, a lot of culture has morphed and become more so diverse that language and mores and styles and fashions, everything is blended and mixed up.
Which is a good thing.
A wonderful thing. But in terms of the art form that is voiceover, and I'll come to you in a moment on this, Helen, John, you've been sort of a go-to guy when it comes to we need the voice to carry along this subject matter. Was this something that even for you kind of morphed your style in terms of gravitas, which is with a capital G what you have? I'm going to keep stroking you through this entire interview, by the way.
Well, I don't know. Listen, there are days when I don't really know what I have. I mean, I'm affected by allergies, you know, the usual stuff that voiceover people have to go through. But I think it probably came from my dad, who had this very authoritative kind of, like, this is the way it is kind of thing, you know. No, I didn't. I never shaped it that way. But for some reason, I had to own whatever I was saying, even if it was work or not. So my mother was a very passionate kind of person. And so I guess I needed to express my feelings in my voice. So if I really love something, I mean, I just, you know, I could feel it in my bones, and somehow it was coming out of my mouth, you know. And if I was really upset about something, as Helen can tell you, whenever we have a dinner party, you know, it's like all of a sudden, wait a minute, can anybody else talk here? You know?
That's the Lasanti, that's the Italian passion.
Excuse me, can I get a word in edgeways?
Well, let me ask you this, lovely Helen, because you are a trained actress and you've been on stage and professional productions and so forth. What John is saying, which is something that is sort of inbred in him, is really what voice acting is, right? It's feeling it so that the voice – talk about that if you will.
In training your voice for the theater, because I basically did the stage, I was on the stage – is very, very different, of course, because I will blow any mic and, you know, you can't talk in the same way and throw your voice in the same way. So when I came here, I really hadn't done much voiceover work. I'd done a demo tape at Richard Branson's place. He had like a recording studio, which was in London, in Little Venice, on a boat. It was really cool.
Of course it was on a boat. It was Richard Branson. It was probably on a yacht with hot and cold champagne being served.
I don't know if I want to hear this.
Yeah, not in front of your husband.
But then I had this demo tape when I came here. And then my problem was trying to not be too over the top. And remember, plosives and S's and all that sort of thing that you don't have to think about on stage.
Exactly. You're projecting on a stage to a whole audience, and it's a more intimate feeling when you're behind the mic.
Yeah.
But you have the most beautiful, and I mean this, the most beautiful, natural, flowing British accent.
Thank you.
And you were telling me, and I wanted to ask you this off and on the air, you were telling me that it's more of a challenge for you to do an American
accent.
Oh, I
can't do an American. I can't do an American. And it was so weird because when I first came over, I would go to sessions and they'd say, well, you know, can you do an American accent? And I'd say, well, but why did you hire me if you want an American accent? I mean, you've got plenty of choice not to. So
You can do a great Southern
accent. Well, I suppose I can do because I can do a bit of a Southern drawl, but only because that's a caricature, really, of a of an accent in some ways, because it's a very caricaturish way I do it, I think. Right.
Now, John, have you employed any accents and character kind of voices over the years? Because
I don't think so.
You see, that's when people try and do British. They always do that.
It's very difficult to say. I just don't know. But I haven't used it, actually, professionally. But Helen tells me I sound like Prince somebody.
It's
or
quite
other.
Good, but you sound very like Prince Charles or something. Okay, it's right. A very posh.
No, I haven't done accents. Although, you know, the funny thing is, just as an aside, because Helen really did just British, okay, great, when I was doing the marketing, since I had been in marketing and I wanted to promote her, you know, we were dating and then got married, I decided that there's got to be a hook here. And the hook was, and what I did this ad, which was, how does an American company, this was when the global economy was just starting out, how does an American company make it sound global, okay? And since the language of business internationally is English, go British. So an American company would hire a British voice to do their marketing, and that would make them sound more international. And it didn't work.
It kind of worked.
We were early with the idea.
Well, it's interesting. In the old days of voiceover, John remembers this, there were a couple of guys, maybe a few women, who did everything, and they were just local people. And it was because we didn't have access to people that weren't over here. You weren't here yet, so we had some actress locally, and those people still exist. They're still around. But now if you need a German actress or a French actor, you can generally find one.
Thing. Right, exactly. Yeah. And I notice now how many British actors and actresses do perfect American accents.
It's incredible. I'm amazed at whether it be House or that show you can name them. I just watched a silly movie with Jane Seymour and she pulled it off like that.
Yeah.
And it's incredible, the power of the ear.
It is
as
true.
They say.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich. My two wonderful guests, John and Helen Lasanti, are here with me in studio. And we're talking about how they've used their voices and how they've made our lives richer and hopefully the added to their bank account because this is what they do for a living. You actually formed a company.
Yep.
Please mention the website as well.
Well, the website's called audiodrama.com. And we have a little sample there, which we haven't changed in years, but it's a pretty broad spectrum of stuff. And there's also a company called the Creative License, which it doesn't do anything, but it's a name that when I left WNEW in New York, and I was on my own for a while, I decided to come to Boston, and I registered the company here. And it was an attempt to not only do voiceovers, but to continue doing marketing and advertising work, because I used to write it and so forth and so on. So audiodrama.com is...
And that begs the question, audiodrama, I think of the old great radio shows,
yes,
which were popular in Britain as they were here. Yeah. Britain had their own. And you guys have done some very impressive work over the years.
Well, there was one that I would be very embarrassed if anybody heard it now. I hope we've destroyed all the copies of it.
Oh, please.
But we went... Do you remember we went on a vacation to Venezuela?
Yeah.
And we went up into the mountains and we went and recorded this drama that you had written.
I had it.
And it was interesting. I think our performances were both very sort of over the top. And it had all these explosions in it and everything. And it was basically supposed to be for an audio book.
Mm-hmm.
Book.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized that if people played it in the car, it could be quite dangerous.
Yes, the explosions of this day and age, you'd turn around and think someone's after you.
Oh, exactly. And it wasn't the best thing we ever did, but it was a fun experiment, wasn't it?
It was an original story that I decided to write because audiobooks had just, or audio tapes had just started up. And so it was called The Commute.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite long. And it was about a couple on their way to work one day in a big city. And basically, there was a terrorist attack. And this was in 1992 or 93.
It was very prescient. it was very prescient. Just before.
We had in it Raf Omani was one of the terrorist voices you heard. My name is Raf Omani. You know, this kind of thing. Mm. We had Bill Clinton's voice in there. I mean, my dear, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And then anyway, so it goes on and on and on. But it starts around a campfire where somebody is talking about the old days, because now the world has been basically destroyed and everybody's living, you know, by a campfire and by the skin of their teeth. And the Pope is involved. Bill Clinton is involved. I don't know how many famous people are involved. And this went on. It was 3 hours long. We sold it on 3 cassettes, made hundreds of copies, which I had to throw away just recently. But it got carried in Australia.
Yeah.
They ran it in Australia.
Like it in Australia, yeah.
And they loved it in Australia, and it ran in San Francisco.
People, our network is being attacked. Get it? I have to get up to McConnell's office and brief her on what's going on. Hillary.
Jim.
I received this.
Deposit $5 million in the following Cayman account. When you transfer the money, you will have your network back. Have you shown this to anyone else, Jim?
No.
Good.
I think that my team should be aware of everything that's going on.
Absolutely not. I'll handle this.
All right. I'll go back downstairs and call you with an update.
Jim?
Hillary?
What's the status of the network? Have you found anything that would allow you to trace the identity of the hacker?
Hillary, let's go take a look at your computer. Termination of network access privileges overridden by Hillary McConnell.
Everything came true.
Two of you do all the voices? Or you did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Well, that's why this is such a magical thing to me. And I'm in it and I love it, you know, just to use your imagination as a listener to hear. And you were doing that when you were a kid, and I was too, John, you know, to hear these voices. And I want to ask you both. I'll start with you, Helen. When you're approaching a piece of copy, let's say, for a commercial, let's call it a commercial, what goes through your mind beyond the words and knowing where you're going to go with the words in terms of, you know, your pacing and so forth? Do you think like an actress, and how do you, if you can explain the process?
I guess I try and think of the most important thing is the audience, really, and who the target audience is, and whether they want something. It has to appeal to them. So is it got to be really sort of chatty and more casual, or is it more sort of formal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it warm or more factual? That sort of thing goes through rather than trying to establish any particular character.
So you've actually just mentioned several descriptive words regarding your voice, and most people don't think of the voice in terms of that many gradations. Mm-hmm. We in this business do.
Mm-hmm.
We know there are different levels of sincerity, warmth, hard edge, soft edge, right?
Yes, 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 exactly. And there's just the sort of more factual way of talking that often they need for more informative pieces. But even for informative pieces, even for very dry pieces of script, often they'll say, oh, we want a bit more warmth. I think warmth is something that a lot of people look for because it just makes it much more appealing to listen to, doesn't it?
John, you were in television for a long time as, you know, director, promotions, all that kind of stuff. Is it still true to this day, do you think, that sometimes the voice part is the stepchild that doesn't get as much attention?
Mm-hmm.
They sink in so much effort into the visuals, and sometimes the voice is forgotten. Sometimes.
Hmm. It's an interesting question, actually. I think it's evolved. But I have a bias because since I'm in the business, I notice the voices all the time and everything. I have, other than local commercials, I don't want to, you know, indict anything here, but the voices are all excellent for the spots they're in. I mean, somebody, the director, I assume, is really doing a good job of making sure that everything fits together. When I'm doing something, I want to know, and I drive clients nuts, unfortunately, which is why I work from home and on my own. But, you know, I want to know what they're trying to do. I want to know what the client wants to do with its product, how they want the audience to feel, as Helen was pointing out. It's like an audience. And sometimes I don't agree. I mean, they'll show me the visual if they have it ready. Sometimes they don't have it ready. Sometimes there's music, and I find music really important.
Oh, the visual and music really does help too, to get into that.
Yeah,
sure.
I've done a lot of spots where I've done it cold, and then I see the final product, and I think, that was a totally wrong voice for that spot. I mean, it should have been this instead of that, you know. I just came off a recent situation with an agency where David Ortiz is involved. He wasn't there in the studio with me, where I had to deliver only two sentences. And I saw the spot. It was terrific, warm, happy, you know, just amazing. It really, really was. And here's this guy everybody loves who has a difficult voice to understand. And he had a few lines.
Of course.
And I tried to read it the way I wanted to because I had heard all this stuff. And I couldn't hear the clients were in the other room. I couldn't even see them. And they go, okay, fine. All right, okay. Can we try it this way? We can try it that way and back and forth. And finally, I got to the end and I said, you know, if you guys could leave the key open so I could actually hear what you're discussing between takes. You know, I don't care if it's critical, but it would help me understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, okay. But they didn't leave the key open. And finally, we get down to the end. And, of course, it didn't occur to me that they've paid for an hour. So they're going to milk it to death. They may already have it from the first take, right?
Mm.
But they were in the end of the hour. And I said, look, guys, I hope you're satisfied. And so I came out. And they said, well, what would you do? And I said, well, because of this and this thing, everybody loves this guy, and, you know, this is a financial thing, and you've got to take care of the warmth and, you know, all this stuff. And I said, I used to be a creative director, and so forth and so on. Of course, that was the wrong thing to say to a bunch of people from an agency. And but they didn't flinch. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, why don't you go back in and do it the way you want? And I said, okay, I will. So I went in, I would do three takes in a row, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And I came out, and they said, good. He said, I think we're going to use one of the lines from the one that we did, and the second line we're going to use the one you did. And I left, and I thought, oh, God, I made a mistake. You know, they're never going to call me back kind of thing. But I don't know where I was going with this. But
Well, I think you made a good point, though, about the impact that the voice can have. And if it fits, it's like casting a movie. If you put the right people in the right part,
But I had to feel it is what I guess I was trying to say. And I saw the spot, I heard the music, and I saw the guy, and I saw the video, and I thought, my reaction has got to be this, and I wanted to do it that way, and I had to push it to get it the way I wanted. Mm.
Sometimes people say in sessions, will you read it your way? Yeah. I just want to hear your interpretation, too. Mm. And that's kind of good.
I've called certain establishments, and Helen has been on the other end of the line.
Yeah.
And this is a good thing, don't worry.
Good.
And the reason I bring this up is because our first impression often is that voice on the telephone. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can impart advice to the general public listening into this podcast, because I've always felt that you answer the phone with warmth and smile in your voice, which is a tough thing, a tough concept to sort of project to certain people. But talk about that and why that's so successful for people.
Well, I think that so many people answer the phone very brusquely, and that immediately sets you in a mood. If I'm if you have a representative on the phone and you're trying to call about something and they answer and they're sort of abrupt, then it tends to escalate and you get abrupt and then they get abrupt and blah blah blah. But you kind of take the wind out of their sails if you immediately answer with a nice, warm, friendly voice. Mm. And it's such a cliche, but it's true that if you actually do smile, you know, when you're talking, people hear it. It comes through in your voice, you know, if you actually smile. And I'm not saying I'm always in a good mood. Sometimes I'm in a terrible mood, but I try not to let it show in my voice. But I do think that the how you speak to people is important. And I'm going to sound like a real old woman now, but the way that people talk, like I have trouble understanding my daughter sometimes and her friends, because they have this way of talking now that's sort of like swallowing the last end of the sentence.
Right. Vocal fry is a very popular thing these days. And I want to ask both of you, if you you're both voice over artists extraordinaire, so there are certain standards, and I like to think that I live up to standards as well, when you're in front of the microphone, particularly delivering something, and those would include pronunciation, obviously, enunciation, proper breath control, things like that. Is that still in vogue in the industry as you see it, John and Helen? Or is it? Are these ideals slipping a bit off the edge?
I think they're slipping a little bit, don't you think?
In terms of a final product, yeah, I think they are slipping to some extent. But I know, for example, I prefer to do things on my own because I don't have breath control of an actor. So I have to take more breaths. So that means more editing, getting them out, because people want them out. Enunciation, you know, that's an issue. We were just discussing with my daughter last night the pronunciation of, what was it? Competent.
Competent.
Competent. Mm-hmm. She says competent. Coppin.
Oh, okay.
Somehow they're dropping the T's these days. And but she would then over-exaggerate and say, competent. I said, no, no, no. That's, you don't want to, that's.
Well, having a mother of Helen's great stature in terms of her enunciation, which is dead on, is perfect.
Oh, it,
poor Emily. She's got you, no offense, and she's got her mother.
That's true.
So she's really in a quandary.
She's in a quandary. The way she talks, she did a voiceover the other day, right?
Yeah.
And she sounded really great.
Yeah,
and her enunciation was really good. So she knows how to do it. It's just that when they talk to each other, talk to their friends, it's not.
I get worried.
They talk. And it is the like every other thing.
Oh, well, the vocal crutches, right? We talk about that.
Is that what they're called? Vocal crutches?
I guess you could call them that when people just. Their ums or their likes or their you knows, and I'm guilty of the you knows as well occasionally. But
she just did a thing with me for, I guess, University of Massachusetts. Anyway, someone has taken on the responsibility of providing funding to make a number of audio courses. I guess they're animated as well for students about bullying, rape, et cetera, all in Massachusetts at the moment. And so it was supposed to be me delivering this stuff, kind of a silly animated character, not bad silly, but nice. And I suggested that why don't we use a girl that sounds old enough to be near adult or an adult, but the female aspect and sounding more like a student than an old guy, you know, and mix the two of us together might be more appealing to the student. And I tried that on the producer, and we just got word this morning that they like the combo. So she and I are going to be doing it together. But
and that brings up a great question that I've often talked about with colleagues and friends. We all have those spots that we forget about as soon as we do them. I mean, I've done thousands. You guys have done thousands. But there are those certain voiceovers you do, voice projects you do that – stay with you because you feel as though they not only were great projects artistically, but they had some impact on people that went beyond selling soap. Can you think of one or two examples of things you did? Maybe it's a public service announcement or maybe it's a certain kind of product or service that had that impact. Does anything come to mind?
Well, I did that stuff for the Christopher McAuliffe Center, the planetarium. That was all really interesting. Talking about the moon and the
The fact that it was her named after her.
Yes,
it was very dramatic.
Yeah,
she did a great job on that.
Something that I remember.
How about you, John?
I like to do a lot of stuff for charity. So I've done San Miguel Allende, Mexican charity, food bank kind of thing. Mm. I don't know what else we've done. But I try to do as much as I can. I did an opioid spot for Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big issue right now. Huge.
Really huge. And so, you know, a lot of times I'll just say, listen, you know, what's your budget is the usual question. I have rates, but it's more like, okay, well, you know, what is it? And what have you got budgeted? And they go, oh, well, how much do you charge? Well, how much do you have budgeted? And they come back with a number. And if it's lower than my rate, but for some reason I feel it's adequate, then I do it because I like the cause.
Excellent. Well, we're both very happy to do as many public service announcement things,
many
even
can,
not
yeah.
paid as we
I
have.
Mean, the fact that what we do for a living is use our voices and smile and read text and act is really not a bad gig.
No,
I'll tell you the one that sticks with me. Years and years ago, there was a company called Quartet Technology, and they asked me if I would just read a series of words, just words, for a digital product they were putting together. And the product actually had a nickname. Edgar was the nickname. And I thought, what's this all about? He said, well, we're trying to develop a product, and this is 20 years ago, that will talk to and respond to paraplegics. In other words, but we need a bank of words, and you guys know what I'm talking about. When you do a script for a company, you need to do a series of vocabulary that is sort of automatic and standard. So I would do things like thank you, hello, goodbye, turn light on, turn light off. Mm. All right, fine, did it. Years go by, hadn't heard, and then I got an update from the company. A gentleman called me and said, "This is, you know, we're working. We got some new words to add." He said, "And by the way, I want you to know that." Somebody that has our machine, you may know somebody who has hit the machine. I said, really, who's that? He said, Christopher Reeve. And I thought,
my gosh.
I just was floored to think that Christopher Reeve at the time was using this product with my voice. I mean, my silly voice that was used. So we all have those moments,
yes,
you know,
yes,
that.
Well, I did one with
definitely.
You. When the BSO did a 9/11 concert.
Yes.
After 9/11. And I remember doing that spot with you guys.
Right, right.
And I did a thing for the Holocaust Museum.
Oh,
a
yes.
A bunch of things that are still up on the web now I can't get out of my head.
Right, right. That's those kinds of things that stay with you because there are so many of the other things which have to pay the bills for the clients and for us. So I'll ask you the fun question, all right? Everyone has horror stories, funny stories, bizarre things that happen in studios. I've got a great story about an impressionist I'll tell you in a minute. But just any bizarre recollections, John? From your many years of doing this,
oh, God.
You must have a book full of them.
I do. And one of the things that I do continuously in the home studio is when I get a client on the phone and they're listening over the phone, I absolutely make sure that we get humor into the conversation immediately, you know, by making some stupid remark like, oh, hi, guys, you know, listen, if I'm kind of, you know, upset, today, just ignore me. Just tell me to go to hell. And everybody laughs, you know.
You break the ice.
You don't know where they are. That some of them are in, you know, London and the other ones are in Hawaii and, you know, they're on the same phone line. But I think I'm hesitant to mention this, but there was a Red Sox thing that I did with you guys.
Let's mention that. Why not? These are fun memories.
Well, there was a baseball player, Nomar Garciaparra, was on the Red Sox. It was quite a hitter and quite an athlete. And I was asked to do a spot by a client, and I came in. And we were, you know, having a good time. We knew each other, and we were friends. And I could not get the name out to the point where we would start. And in those days, you couldn't quite edit in just the name, you know, because it was tape and stuff. So they really wanted me to start from the top or that paragraph and do it all. And so each time I would get to the name, I would blow it, you know,
right
to the point where I was like trying so hard. I was making up It wasn't make, not consciously, but it was coming out totally different each time.
And you get desperate.
And I looked through the window into the control room, and the engineer, the client, practically were rolling on the floor.
And I was there, too. I was on the floor.
And you were on there.
I still have the lint on my shirt to prove it.
And it was hysterical. I totally lost it. I was laughing.
If you can't break up in a studio, it should be labeled studio/breakup room because everyone has those. Helen, I'm going to ask you the same question, but I'm going to add a little bit. I'm going to add a little bit because you've also been a stage actress in London and here, and you've had an opportunity to work, you know, in front of thousands of people, I'm sure. So any funny story that stays with you? Before we wrap up here.
Oh, I can't really think of a funny story in the theater. I mean, except the old thing, which I still have nightmares about when I go to sleep occasionally, is just forgetting your lines. Mm. But I don't think I ever really had anything. I did with a voiceover, though, when I first came over here.
Oh, tell us that story.
And
share it with us.
I didn't really know we had the setup from home. I don't know if I ever told you that. Anyway, we had this set up from home, and I wasn't quite sure how to use it. I mean, I wasn't quite sure how to use this MP. We had mini discs.
Oh, yes.
A mini disc player, and I had to sort of do the mini disc. And I was recording it as I was doing it on the phone to this client, and I was sort of winging it a little bit. And I did this long thing, and it was a lot with a lot of pickups and a lot of stuff. But I had marked the pickups. I had actually... It was before you put things on the screen, so I had a piece of paper in front of me, and I did do a lot of notes. And then I went to leave the studio, and I pressed the wrong button, and I deleted everything.
Helen, that is a story for the ages, and we've all done it. I've probably done it 10 times over the times you've done it, so don't worry.
It's me too.
But it is. It stays with you forever.
And then I never did call the client to tell them that. I had made enough notes, so I immediately went back in and redid the whole thing and sent it to them, and they never said anything.
I've got one quick story. We had a client come in, and it was a coffee chain, small chain, not the big, not the double D. It was a small one. And this client, the owner, was there, and he brought in – and this is always a problem, as you know, John. I brought in my nephew, who's a great mimic, okay? All right, fine. And the spots were all written. One was for Elvis. One was for Arnold Schwarzenegger. One was for Rodney Dangerfield and all this. So there were three spots. And we bring in the guy, and here's the guy, right? And he comes in. He says, I'll be right back. He leaves for about 15 minutes, comes back dressed from head to toe like Elvis. The Vegas Elvis. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I have to get into character. Now, we just talked earlier in our podcast here with you guys about how you do it. It's a very natural, organic thing. And if I said to you that he stunk, that would be an understatement. He was the worst Elvis ever.
Oh, my God.
Then it was time to do Arnold. And the client's starting to sweat. Then it's time to do Arnold. He comes back, changes into a black leather jacket, the dark glasses, you know, carrying a plastic gun. I mean, the whole thing. Anyway, this went on for 3 hours. Every impression sounded like...
They were all awful.
We couldn't use any of them. I ended up doing two or three of the voices only because they were desperate. They had no, you know, it's not that hard. And I didn't have to dress up. But that's always be concerned when they say, I've got a nephew or my kid brother or my Uncle Mo does this kind of stuff.
Oh, my God, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you keep the – do you still have the tape?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In the vault.
Yeah, that would be fun to listen to.
In the secret vault where all the good stuff is, where the Nomar Garcia Parra stuff is, no doubt.
Right. You have to keep on the right side of it.
Oh, I know, absolutely.
Before we wrap up, you guys actually have to go and do more gigs, which is great. This is fun, isn't it?
It is fun.
Oh, yeah.
It is
fun,
really. It is a great
– this was the best career move I ever made. You meet some really nice people. You're exposed to dozens of very interesting subjects, whether it's military about tanks or, you know, pharmaceuticals or whatever. I mean, it's just amazing. You get this very broad spectrum of life, people, and...
You learn a lot because you're always saying what an expert you are in medical things with all the medical scripts you read.
The old joke, you play a doctor on TV, well, you know.
Well, you are.
You're basically a doctor on the voice track.
He knows all about it.
I know, and it's funny because you read these scripts and you sound so authoritative, And then as soon as you read them, you totally forget what the hell you read, and you have no idea what the hell you...
That's so true. And, so true.
But I want to thank you both for spending a little time with me and sharing your voices with us, because your voices are magnificent, but it's what... It's behind the voice that really makes a difference.
No, thank you.
And again, the name of the website, John?
Audiodrama.com.
Audiodrama.com. And your lovely daughter, Emily, is about to graduate next year.
She is from U, Maryland. Yeah.
All right. And you're still using her. You're still putting her to work.
We're still putting her to work. She's got to pay for her tutoring.
Right, the rest of her college.
It's a good way to subsidize the college.
Well, I hope she doesn't hear this, by the way. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'll send it directly to her. John and Helen Lasanti, a power couple if ever there was one in the voiceover world. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to On Mic with me, Jordan Rich, and we'll have much more to come.